Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson. Well, marketing of food products in the United States is an area that has a lot of attention. And the key spot to get a pulse on what's happening from the farm level and production practices and where country of origin and all that is really a role played by the Agriculture Marketing Service. And I'm happy to say that back to visit with us is Dr. Craig Morris, the Deputy Administrator of the Agriculture Marketing Service. Craig, welcome. You've got quite a plateful. Maybe reintroduce people to the range of things that you're handling at the Agriculture Marketing Service.
Thanks, Roger. Yes, we have a pretty large basket here at AMS. Given that our charge is to facilitate the marketing of U.S. agricultural products, there's really not a product that we don't touch in one way or another. AMS is primarily divided along commodity lines, so my portfolio carries everything from livestock and meat to fish and grain to seed, poultry, eggs, and a variety of other commodities we touch through certain programs such as the Country of Origin Labeling Program and those that expand beyond that defined base.
One of the areas that you have responsibility for are what's called checkoffs. And many people are not familiar with that term of what a checkoff program is. And in fact, I think we've actually got officially other names for them other than checkoffs. But in agriculture, we call them checkoffs. And I'm going to ask you to kind of get into that. But maybe for consumers, I mean, they've known over the years the got milk and the other white meat and so forth, that those were funded by industry groups. And those usually were checkoff programs. Could you explain how those programs work, because you have an oversight responsibility for those programs?
Absolutely. At AMS, we oversee, I believe it's now, some 22 different research and promotion programs. I oversee six of those. So I have beef, pork, lamb, egg, soybeans, and sorghum. So those are the six I oversee, which are six of the larger that we have in the agency. You had mentioned dairy. Obviously, dairy is the largest. Those programs, in general, the ones that I oversee were established under standalone statutes, so actual independent laws passed by Congress, so the Beef Act, the Pork Act, the Soybean Act, those are standalone. And then in 1996, Congress passed what we refer to affectionately somewhat as the Generic Act, where programs that have been brought on board since 1996 are authorized by that law, and that would cover for me, for example, sorghum and lamb.
Now, at the very beginning, when these programs were established, it never required 100% agreement. How did those get going if enough farmers said that they wanted to be able to really kind of tax themselves and to be able to promote their industry? How did that get started with what percentage of farmers did it take to be able to say, let's have a program and then actually put a new program in force?
Those numbers are really determined by a variety of factors. As I had referenced, the standalone statutes, so egg, beef, pork, soybeans, those are actually spelled out specifically in their specific authorizing statutes. And then for the programs that have come on board under the Generic Act since 1996, those numbers are really determined by the industry themselves. What we do at AMS is just ensure that when a law is passed by Congress, that it's implemented in accordance with its authorizing legislation. And so, as you pointed out, certain programs like egg, for example, require supermajorities of producers to make changes to their program, whereas other programs that I oversee are simple majorities. What we're doing is just making sure that the wishes of the producers, given that these programs really are opportunities for producers to pool their own resources and direct that money towards developing new uses and building demand for their commodities.
So initially, though, there can be people in an industry, the trade association or so forth, and they say, we need to do something to build demand for beef or pork or soybeans. And then they come up with a plan that would be a rate and a checkoff and so forth. And then they come and show you that they've got here's their plan, here's what they want to do. and then have a national referendum of everybody that raises that product. And I believe you said that in some cases it might be 50% of those voting and some different percentages.
That's right. And again, pre-1996, industries would have to work with Congress to pass a law to stand up a program that eventually USDA would take the law and then try to implement through order and regulation. Since 1996, for the newer programs that we brought on board, we look to industries to come together and present USDA with a proposed, what we would call proposed order, that would exercise their authority under that generic act of 1996 to set up a new checkoff. And if we get this proposed order at USDA and determine, based on our review, that it most likely would enjoy a support from the industry that would be assessed, we could put that in the Federal Register for comment and then eventually implement that program. But again, producers would have the opportunity through a vote that is outlined the requirements of that vote within the order itself, whether or not that program would begin collecting assessments or would continue in operation. One of the things you mentioned that I think is really important for everyone to understand about these programs is across the board, it's those being assessed that are the ones making the decision as to whether or not these programs get up and running. So it truly is asking those that would be most directly affected by the programs if they support it moving.
Well, I'm curious, does this exist outside of agriculture? Because I'm familiar with these checkoff programs, but is this something that's just unique to agriculture to have this kind of mechanism to tax themselves for their industry?
It's largely an agricultural issue. There are other programs like propane has a program, I know, and there are other examples where industries pool their money. Certainly, the federal oversight is something that USDA exercises with these programs, and certainly of the 22 we oversee, those are probably some of the most prominent examples of individuals choosing to effectively tax themselves and have that money come under federal oversight as those individuals being assessed determine how to use those funds.
How does it break out between taxing, assessing the farmers themselves versus somebody up the chain? For example, can some of the marketing or the brands in an industry, are they ever assessed or is it always back to the farm level?
It really, again, depends on the program. We have programs like the Land Board, for example, that I oversee. That is a pass-through. So every time the animal moves through the marketing chain up into including slaughter, the money basically carries with that animal, and then at slaughter the dollars are assessed. Beef, every time a bovine animal is transacted, or in the case of imported beef meat into the United States, when it comes into the country, there's an assessment. And so a given animal, let's say a steer might be born or a calf might be born in Florida, is sold for backgrounding in Oklahoma, is then sold again to a feedlot in Kansas, and then is sold again to a packing house in Nebraska. Each time that animal changed hands, there's another dollar that goes into that fund. We have other programs that only assess at harvest. We have a variety of different mechanisms. So it's really specific for that program, and those are the details that are really defined either, again, if it was a standalone law by essentially the law, or in the programs that have been developed since 1996 by the industry that proposed the order to USDA.
So if an industry gets themselves established and they have millions of dollars that they have to work with to be able to get a message out to consumers or do production or other kinds of research, do they put their list of what they want to do together and bring it into the USDA for you to approve it before they spend it?
Well, that's a great question. In general, USDA looks to the industry to determine what they want to do with their funds within very defined sideboards. There's things that they can't use the money for. Lobbying is the obvious example that is most talked about. The money cannot be used to influence government policy or action. However, one of the things that USDA does look to the boards to do through the secretary's appointment of the actual producers that make those decisions is to come up with clear budgets that are submitted into USDA for approval, clear what we call return on investment studies at least every 5 years across the board and in certain programs more frequently, so that producers understand with the money that's being taken in How effective has that money been? And then obviously, what are the budgets and you know, what is being done with the money itself? Certain programs decide to focus a lot more of their resources towards research. Other programs, a lot more towards advertising. But in general, those decisions are really made by the producers that are appointed by the secretary that make those decisions on behalf of their industry.
What do you do if they come in with a program and they're going to advertise that if you eat this product, you'll never have a heart attack or make some other health claim? How do you get yourself into the middle of those kind of questions?
Well, that's that area beyond lobbying that we do step in on. Clearly, the programs cannot be used to disparage other commodities. We have actually on our website what we call the AMS guidelines for the oversight of research and promotion programs. Those guidelines outline for the boards certain requirements that we have across the board. One of the other areas is claims must be based in science, rooted in fact, and truthful and not misleading. So we do have the ability to review and approve all projects. And in reading that, we can and have not allowed certain boards to initiate certain campaigns that we did not feel were either truthful or potentially would have disparaged other commodities.
Well, that brings up another issue, that there's a program being proposed, as the organic program is proposing a checkoff on organics. And for the most part, I think organics are now excluded from the other checkoff programs. There's some specific guidelines. And so organics are suggesting that they have a new program. But I know some of the critics already, it's not even out the door yet, but some of the critics are saying they're concerned because they want to be able to say that organic is better than other production practices. And yet you have a policy that says that you can't disparage other products. This hasn't really come up before about production practices being disparaged, but it sounds like you'll be applying that same standard. Is that right? And in fact, let me just go back and just ask you, maybe kind of explain where this process is as far as the proposal for an organic checkoff program.
Well, yes. Organic producers within given commodities that have checkoffs have the ability to not be assessed. And one of the issues that the organic industry is considering is whether or not they should be assessed under their own organic checkoff. That is going to potentially take a number of forms. I'm not actually directly over that effort here for the agency, so I can't speak to it in great detail, or should not speak to it in great detail based on the information I know. However, I will say that all of us are very cognizant of the concerns by production agriculture, commodity agriculture, about potentially an organic checkoff putting confusion in the marketplace based on claims. Certainly nobody wants one checkoff to be using their funds to combat campaigns being done by another checkoff. So one of the things that we're going to have to do here at USDA is if an organic checkoff gets up and running, through our orientation of the producers that will be appointed by the secretary, help them understand the way that the money can be used. And in this particular case, clearly the way the money cannot, because we do not want to find ourselves in a position here in AMS of having checkoffs, frankly combating each other with the funds they have available, trying to differentiate their products in the marketplace.
So, in fact, I mean, they may be able to say that if it's organic, it's not produced with certain kinds of pesticides, for example, but they can't say that that's necessarily better for you. I mean, people that feel that way are going to understand that message. It's an area. I don't want to draw you into that too much, but that's the kind of thing that's a new frontier, I would guess.
That's absolutely true. And it's no different than the nutritional messaging that you see come out of a lot of the boards that I oversee. Beef checkoff, pork checkoff, lamb checkoff, spend a lot of time talking about the positive attributes associated with those commodities in the diet, but then we don't allow them to go around and disparage other commodities.
Now, another thing I think that the public kind of worries about is that they hear rumors that these programs are somehow controlled or manipulated by big ag, and in the case of organics, there could be big companies that get involved too. How do you oversee the way that these programs are governed to be sure that the farmers are in control of the program?
This administration has really done a great job, I think, of trying to put as much diversity on the boards as possible. And so, in general, industries nominate individuals to the secretary for appointment. And one of the things that this secretary has done, I believe, a great job of is ensuring that there's substantial diversity on those boards that are making the funding decisions on behalf of their industry. And when I say diversity, I don't mean just racial or gender. I mean diversity in thought, diversity in operational size, a variety of factors. And I think that's, at the end of the day, the best way for an industry to keep its checkoff representing all producers being assessed is to have the very diversity of that industry represented on the board making those decisions.
Well, that brings up one other area, and this is an area of the country of origin. I want to talk about that because in some cases, I know that checkoffs apply to imported product, too. So it might be whatever the product is, it's not only checking off farmers here, but maybe it imports it is. And then your department not only is involved with that part of it, but to also maybe you could explain your responsibilities about this whole identification of the country of origin.
Well, yeah, that's a big issue. You know, the land board, for example, that we oversee is the American Land Board. It assesses only domestic land production, and in that they are able to differentiate their product. Obviously, when the U.S. sheep and lamb industry came together to set up their checkoff, they viewed imported lamb as a commodity distinct and separate that they needed to be able to differentiate themselves from. And so the American Land Board does quite a bit, not only cooperatively with the importers in this country and the countries that export lamb to the United States, but also independently, where they talk about the unique attributes of American lamb. By contrast, programs like the Beef Checkoff, for example, does assess imports, and in doing so, really have to promote beef generally, although there are brand partnerships and things that they get involved in. In general, the Beef Checkoff is trying to build demand and develop new uses for beef, be it imported or domestic.
I think there's a lot of confusion out there about what are the rules right now as far as country of origin, because there was a lot of publicity on the fact that there were changes when it came to, I believe, beef and pork on country of origin. And yet those changes really didn't extend to the other commodities, I understand it. Could you clarify that a little bit and how that might change your responsibilities at all, whether this country of origin labeling issue that involved, I think, again, beef and pork. What are the implications of that for how you guys do your job?
Well, Congress, as you pointed out, they repealed the authority for a mandatory country origin labeling program at retail grocery stores for beef and pork, whole, muscle, and ground. And so we followed through with the regulatory actions to implement that. We still have an up-and-running country origin labeling program at grocery stores across the country for fish and shellfish, not only for country of origin, but method production, be it farm-raised or wild-caught. Obviously, in the produce aisle, be it the fresh produce aisle or the frozen produce aisle, country of origin is still required there. And then also in the meat case for such commodities as lamb and chicken and goat and a variety of others.
Are there any new things on the horizon that people want assurances that you're going to be getting involved with on certification?
Clearly, what we're hearing a lot more of now is the use of the USDA Process Verified program as a solution to market needs. Just recently, the secretary actually made a statement about concerns relative to whether local regional claims were accurate. There was a story that ran here not long ago that was showing that basically restaurants and in other places, some of the local claims, when upon inspection by independent investigators, found that they weren't true. And so the secretary had pointed out this is potentially a way for the Process Verified program to step in and address an issue and help give consumers that confidence that when they're making purchasing decisions that are important to them, certainly paying a premium for certain marketing attributes, potentially the Process Verified program is a way that these market niches can really be in a more sustainable way. And I use sustainable in a manner of oftentimes consumers can respond very negatively if they assume things to be true and are shown that they're not. And so the Process Verified program is a way that if there's a market out there for a premium to be paid for things like locally raised, Process Verified Shield can really help give a consumer the assurance that there's really fact behind that claim.
You know, actually, we did an interview on Farm to Table Talk with the person that wrote that story down in Tampa Bay, Florida, and it was a really, really interesting story. And when I interviewed her, I asked her, and she said, you know, people can just say anything on the menu, and there's no enforcement. And I said, well, what about organic? And she pointed out that organic, that there are actually substantial fines, and if people are claiming to be organic, and she also went on with her series and did the same thing at farmers markets. But I thought it was interesting that she's very aware of that, and other people that are reporters are aware that organic has something standing behind it where these other claims there's no enforcement. What are the kinds of ways that in the future, like the secretary might like to have you look into some sort of role that if people make claims that it's from local farms, that it is in fact from local farms?
Well, I think what he's saying is the Process Verified program is voluntary, so that is, and it's for a fee. And so this would be for a market player to want to differentiate themselves by saying, I'm making the claim, I'm expecting you to pay a premium, but I'm going to make the investment behind that claim to have you have the insurance that I'm following through on it. So what the Process Verified program isn't, and what AMS is not in large measure, except for in those rare examples where Congress has given us authority to regulate a marketing claim like organic claims, in general, sister agencies like the Food Safety Inspection Service or Food and Drug Administration, they're really responsible for making sure that claims associated with food products are truthful and not misleading. AMS, we step in and help underpin those claims with credibility when the industry chooses to invite us in.
Well, I tell you, I really appreciate your taking the time to visit with us because we're talking to Dr. Craig Morris, and the Deputy Administrator for the Agricultural Marketing Service. Craig, you're just right in the middle of so much right now, and I think that given the fact that people want to know more and more about how their food is produced, they should be feeling good about the fact that there is an agency, the Agricultural Marketing Service, that is in the middle of a wide range of things on the marketing communications efforts. If people want to find out more about your programs, where should they look?
Well, obviously, come to the USDA website. The Agricultural Marketing Service has invested quite a bit in improving our website, putting a lot more information out there in plain language. I think you're absolutely right that it is an exciting time in agriculture. Change is constant in agriculture, that is for sure. But I think it's really an exciting time for food. And I think a lot of the things that we do here in AMS to help facilitate the marketing of U.S. agricultural products and frankly, help consumers better understand where their food comes from is doing, it's a very timely work today, I think.
Well, Dr. Craig Morris, I really appreciate your being on Farm to Table Talk. Dr. Craig Morris is the USDA's Agriculture Marketing Service Deputy Administrator. Craig, thank you very much.
And thank you, Roger.
Thanks for joining the Farm to Table Talk podcast. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and subscribe to listen regularly on SoundCloud or iTunes to Farm to Table Talk.